Peter B. Collins with your news and comment. It's Wednesday, October 2nd, 2013. Remember, those who ignore history are doomed to repeat it. We're the doomed. Today, in an in-depth interview released to subscribers at peterbcollins.com, we talk with Professor Christopher Pyle of Mount Holyoke College. Back in 1970, and his memory still works, he led the charge to expose and dismantle an apparatus that was used to spy on American citizens exercising their First Amendment rights. Chris Pyle helped expose and, as he puts it, put out of business the Army Intelligence Division. He teaches political science, and as you're about to hear, he's quite outspoken and candid. And today in our conversation, we talk about the history of surveillance, and that in particular we have recently learned through the work of writers Matthew Aid and William Burr that two key members of the United States Senate were subject to NSA surveillance during the administration of Lyndon Johnson. And the surprise was a Republican, Howard Baker, a pro-Vietnam War senator, was one of those who was surveilled, along with Senator Frank Church, the Idaho Democrat, who was a critic of the Kennedy-Johnson War in Vietnam, and went on to lead the famous Church Commission that exposed, and we thought, put a lid and put an end to, the kinds of illegal and unconstitutional spying that led to the creation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and we thought, an end to assassinations and to other illegal activities by the American intelligence community. It's a fascinating interview, and during it, I played him a clip of Russell Tice, the NSA whistleblower who you've heard here on this podcast, who explicitly states that he witnessed the installation of telephone taps on a variety of telephones associated with Senator Dianne Feinstein, who now chairs the Senate Intelligence Committee and is one of the biggest cheerleaders for the excessive, aggressive, unconstitutional surveillance that occurs today. And we raise the question once again. It was the professor who first mentioned J. Edgar Hoover. To what extent are people like Feinstein, who have been wiretapped, subject to blackmail or the threat of blackmail by the leaders of the NSA? Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Professor Chris Pyle.
I think we need more leakers. We need people to have the courage and wits and imagination to leak more and more of this information. We put the U.S. Army Intelligence Command out of business in 1972, not by congressional hearings per se, not by the independence of Senator Ervin. We did it by unremitting disclosures to the press. I happened to be the instrument of those disclosures. Every week we had a new story in the press somewhere in the country about the abuse of authority by the military. And when Nixon ordered the military to go after his enemies, the military said, we can't do it. We have no security. Well, when you're violating the Constitution, you shouldn't have any security. And we need people in the agencies themselves who disclose this information to responsible reporters, who carefully make sure that it doesn't violate important sources and methods, but yet alerts the American people to what is going on without their knowledge. We need that desperately.
That's Professor Chris Pyle of Mount Holyoke College. Yes, he says we need more leakers. Well, the risk to leakers is very great, and so I hope there will be more, but they have to play it carefully or they'll wind up living for life in Russia, like Ed Snowden may be doing. The New York Times, desperate to catch up on the Snowden leaks that are mostly coming from The Guardian in Britain, put Charlie Savage on the case, and Charlie's a good reporter. His limits, I think, are set by his editors and the assignments he's given. But the existence of a pilot program at the NSA was recently declassified by Clapper, the perjuring director of national intelligence, James Clapper. But this is the first time that it has been publicly disclosed. And it tells us that the NSA in 2010 and 2011 conducted what they describe as a secret pilot project to test the collection of bulk data about the location of Americans' cell phones. As we'll address in a moment, this issue was raised in testimony before the United States Senate last week. Now, the Times has obtained a copy of the pre-written answer, the talking points supplied to Clapper for the occasion if and when this question came up. And the prepared answer says the NSA does not currently collect locational information under Section 215 of the Patriot Act. But that is a very carefully crafted denial. That's why it was written in advance. And let me just read this to you again. The NSA does not currently collect locational information under Section 215 of the Patriot Act. So, let's just examine that statement. It could mean that the NSA does currently collect locational information under some other authority, like, for example, the amended FISA law. Or, when they run out of more recent legislation, they go back to the blank check that Bush signed after 9/11, the authorization for use of military force, which was extremely broad. And so this denial is absolutely meaningless, because it is explicit to Section 215 of the Patriot Act, and it doesn't exclude the other legal bases that might be cited by the NSA. The pre-written answer goes on, in 2010 and 2011, NSA received samples in order to test the ability of its systems to handle the data format, but that data was not used for any other purpose and was never available for intelligence analysis purposes. Now, that's a long-winded way of saying, oh, we tested this out, but we didn't roll it out, and when we tested it, we didn't examine any of the information that was collected. You believe that? Yeah, right. Senator Ron Wyden said in a statement Wednesday, there's much more to know about this than the government has declassified. Quote, after years of stonewalling on whether the government has ever tracked or planned to track the location of law-abiding Americans through their cell phones, once again, the intelligence leadership has decided to leave most of the real story secret, even when the truth would not compromise national security. So, Ron Wyden is telling us that the carefully crafted statement delivered by the proven perjurer James Clapper is a limited hangout. It's got some truthiness, but it is not the whole story. And Wyden has been a critic of these programs, and back in 2011 and again this year, he filed legislation that would require warrants before obtaining someone's locational data, and that it must be for a criminal investigation. It does, his bill language leaves ambiguous whether a warrant is necessary in the context of a national security investigation. And at the hearing, Wyden asked Alexander whether the NSA has ever collected or made any plans to collect American cell site information in bulk. And quoting from his document, he said the NSA is not receiving cell site location data and has no current plans to do so under Section 215 of the Patriot Act. See, that qualifier is always in there, which renders the statement vague at best, meaningless at worst. And Charlie Savage writes, it's legally unclear, and this relates to Supreme Court decisions, whether long-term tracking of people's locations and movements raises privacy rights under the Fourth Amendment. A case dating back to 1979, involving small-scale collection of metadata about phone calls. In that case, the Supreme Court ruled that such records are not protected by the Constitution because people have already revealed the existence of their calls to telephone companies. Well, I don't think we have a choice about that. At any rate, that conflicts with the 2012 decision in the case of a police secretly putting a GPS tracker on a suspect's car without a warrant, and the court said flatly that that is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. So maybe at a date in the future, the court will review these issues. In the meantime, we still don't know what Keith Alexander's answer is to Senator Wyden on to what extent cell phones are being tracked. We'll cover the government shutdown here in just a moment. I want to thank the people who haven't shut down my operation here because they continue to subscribe. People like Andy Krieger, he's been around for a while. So's Don Sisney. My thanks, too, to Mona Kobus and Carl Harrison. They are monthly subscribers supporting this podcast. You can do it, too. You know the drill. You go to my website right under my picture. You click on the sign-up link, $5 a month, cancel anytime, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. It all goes to a great cause, if I do say so myself. And your inducement, if you act now with a new annual subscription, a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee, lovingly grown by Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. And I have just a few more copies of Savelle Edmonds' Classified Woman. The other way you can help us out is to steer your web business to GoDaddy.com. Right now, if you sign up for web hosting with unlimited storage and bandwidth, the rates start at just $1.99 a month, and you'll get your domain name free. Follow the link at the top of the show file for this podcast for another screaming deal from GoDaddy.com. Day two of the partial government shutdown. President Obama called Republican and Democratic leaders of Congress to the White House for an afternoon meeting today. And he is insisting that Republicans end their attempts to extort unrelated measures and to fund the government through a continuing resolution, and also to raise the debt ceiling without any further threats of delay or extortion related to other issues that are pets of the Republicans who have the majority in the House. And the other thing the president did was call on his bankster buddies to put pressure on the party of corporate America. Well, the number one party, the Republicans, the Democrats aren't far behind. And so he deployed Treasury Secretary Jack Lew and Gene Sperling, the economic advisor, to hold a conference call with leaders of the Business Roundtable. Lloyd Blankfein, CEO of Goldman Sachs, was there at the White House this morning. Yeah, all the people who love our government and economy so much. Anyway, the comment from Blankfein, there's a precedent for government shutdown, but there's no precedent for a default. We're the most important economy in the world. We're the reserve currency of the world. Payments have to go out to people, and if money doesn't flow in, then money doesn't flow out. So the pressure is coming from business leaders onto Republicans. But the Republicans continue to cling to the notion that Obamacare is so unpopular and so bad for America that they're justified in continuing this pointless effort. So Michael Steele, a spokesman for John Boehner, says the entire government is shut down right now because Washington Democrats refuse to even talk about fairness for all Americans under Obamacare. Offering to negotiate only after Democrats get everything they want is not much of an offer. So it's neener, 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 neener. And I want to credit Rachel Maddow. You know, I sometimes criticize her for deficiencies or things that I believe she doesn't cover adequately. But I only have praise for her program last night on Tuesday, because she opened by describing for people the radical gerrymandering of the districts for members of Congress. And this is particularly acute in red, red states. And she pointed out, I think I have this figure correct from memory, that of the freshman members of Congress in the last two cycles who identify with the Tea Party, only 7% of their districts produced a majority for President Obama in the 2012 elections. And that's a barometer of how safe these people are and beyond the reach of rational thought and of political consequences. Because these Tea Party radicals come from such safe districts that the only risk they face is if they disappoint the radical right, they'll be taken out by somebody who professes to be even more radical and more conservative than they are. So they're not at risk from a moderate or from a Democrat in any way, shape, or form. And against that backdrop, Rachel, in a second segment, gave us a recent history of Republican comments. People who were giddy, that's the term they used in tweets and other comments, they were giddy at the prospect of shutting down the government. This has been a Tea Party pipe dream since 2010. And listen to this excerpt. It's about 5 minutes, but I think it's worth it, because Rachel Maddow really lays out for you the extreme coalition of Republicans who were delighted Monday at midnight when they got their wish and the government shut down.
For one contingent of the Republican Party in Congress, the contingent that happens to be running the Republican Party in Congress right now, the events of the last 24 to 48 hours have been something akin to winning the showcase showdown or picking the right vowel or whatever. From the Washington Post yesterday, on cusp of showdown, House conservatives excited. It's wonderful, said Republican Congressman John Culberson, clapping his hands to emphasize the point. We're 100% united, he said. Congressman Culberson was also the person who described as giddy the atmosphere at a House Republican meeting over the weekend where they voted to shut down the government. Representative John Culberson of Texas said that as he and his colleagues were clamoring for a vote, he shouted out his own encouragement. I said, like 9/11, let's roll. As Congress hurtled through last night's midnight deadline and we shut down, in those final moments when it became clear that we would shut down, Republican Congressman Dave Schweikert was so psyched about what was going on that he found himself at a loss for words. Talking to a reporter from the National Journal, Congressman Schweikert was eager and excited, his eyes wide and his smile broadening. He had a discernible spring in his step. News that to the rest of the country had been cause for disappointment and anxiety and anger, for some Republican members of Congress, has just been awesome. They've been really happy. Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann told the Washington Post, quote, "We are very excited. It is exactly what we wanted." The Republican Party, of course, took control of the House in the 2010 midterm elections. They got the House. John Boehner became the Speaker. But before that election, before they even got control of the House of Representatives, 6 months before that election, Republicans running for Congress and conservative media and prominent voices on the right were already promising, already hoping even, that if the Republicans could win themselves the majority in the House, they would go for a government shutdown, even before they got elected.
Now there's going to be a government shutdown, just like in 95 and 96. But we're going to win it this time, and I'll be fighting on your side.
We line those things up chronologically. Those were all before the 2010 election. That was August, September, October, all 2010, all before the election. Giddy was the word used repeatedly to describe how Republicans felt before the 2010 election, about how winning that election would mean that they could shut down the government. Quote, "I'm almost giddy thinking about a government shutdown next year." Utah Senator Mike Lee, then a candidate for the Senate, he was also clap your hands, jump for joy, giddy at the prospect of being voted into government in order to be allowed to shut it down. He was giddy about winning and then using power in the Senate to do just that. It was not a secret that the wave of Republicans who swept into office in those midterm elections in 2010 were psyched about sticking a wrench in the government, about making the government stop working. They ran for office promising their base that that is what they would do with power if they got it. And starting right after the election, just days after the 2010 election, they got to work on what they said they would work on.
Are you willing to participate in what would lead to a shutdown of the federal government to stop this monstrosity from going down the tracks?
I agree with Congressman Boehner. We need to do whatever's necessary to make sure this bill never goes into effect.
Congressman Nunley, would you be willing, I think you just answered it with health care, but when it comes to fiscal policy, are you willing to participate in a shutdown of the federal government if that's the only way to get the president to come to the table?
Yeah,
We will do what we have to do to shut down the government if we have to.
So you think even if that were to happen, theoretically, it wouldn't be as bad as people make it out?
No, I don't think it would be at all. I really don't.
Do you think shutdown should be off the table?
Everything ought to be on the table.
I got to tell you, most people in my district say shut it down. This country very well may need some sort of shock therapy.
Would it be a good thing fiscally and philosophically if the government did shut down for a few weeks and the American people could see life would go on without the federal government for a little while?
I don't think it would hurt one bit.
Even if it means, say, showing how serious we are. Okay, government's going to have to shut down.
If liberals in the Senate would rather play political games and shut down the government instead of making a small down payment on fiscal discipline and reform, I say, shut it down.
It has been roughly 2.5 years since Republicans got control of the House in that election. And in those 2.5 years, they've threatened to shut down the government or default on the national debt 7 times. They were unsuccessful 6 of those times, but the 7th time is the charm, apparently. This week has not given them any sort of legislative victory. It has not helped them achieve some sort of policy change that they believe addresses the nation's problems. They just ran out the clock and got the government to stop working, which is what they have said they wanted all along. There's been a variety of reasons why they said they wanted it. But the only thing that's been consistent is that they said they wanted a shutdown.
But if they had it, wouldn't know what to do with it. And together we shut it down.
That's the rapper Drake. It's called Shut It Down. And it's mostly white guys, with a little help from Michelle Bachmann in the Congress, who are promoting the government shutdown as a legitimate political move. And I doubt that most of them listen to Drake, but could be their theme song in some cases. In other news today, a federal judge has revisited a decades-old court settlement in New York City, restricting how the police department conducts surveillance, after civil rights lawyers have accused the department of breaking those rules by monitoring Muslims. Now, this is interesting because we opened with a little history going back to the 60s and 70s with Professor Chris Pyle. And this is based on a precedent that was set in the early 1970s, a decree called the Handschuh Decree that requires the police to justify their approach to targeted groups. And the latest problems stem from the police department's monitoring of Muslims where they eat, study, and worship as part of so-called counterterrorism programs. In February, civil rights lawyers filed papers seeking a court order barring further surveillance of Muslims without evidence of crimes and a court-appointed auditor to oversee police activities that were flagrant and persistent. The police measures directed at Muslims violate the Handschuh Decree, quote, because they're not rooted in the fact that there's a criminal predicate, said attorney Paul Shavini. They're rooted in the fact that the subjects are Muslims. And by any other name, this is profiling, and it is inappropriate to track people by group, ethnicity, and particularly their religious beliefs. Interesting study released by a group called Death Penalty Information Center, and they're critical of the death penalty, and it is stunning. The majority of executions in the United States originate in just 2% of the counties across the entire nation. That's right. The vast majority of executions, more than half since 1976, originated in only 2% of America's counties. Put another way, 15% of the counties in the United States have given rise to all of the executions carried out in the modern era. So it's a minority, 15% of the total counties, more than half originated in just 2%. That is an extreme minority. and it shows the uneven, disproportionate application of the death penalty based on the origins, the geographic origins of the conviction. Richard Dieter, director of Death Penalty Information Center, quote, "It's becoming clear that it comes down simply to which side of the county line you were standing in when you committed a murder that can put you on death row. It's nothing to do with the heinousness of the crime. There are wild disparities between counties." Now, even within the state of Texas, which is number one in executions and snuffed 15 prisoners last year, the discrepancies are very wide. Just four of the 200, you know, there are 254 counties in Texas? Holy cow, I didn't know that. Just four of them, Harris, which is Houston, Dallas, Tarrant, and Bexar, account for more than half of the nearly 500 executions that Texas has carried out since 1976. Houston, Harris County has carried out 115 of those, a record number that in no small part can be explained by the affinity for judicial killings of its district attorney in the 1990s. Of course, George W. Bush was the gung-ho execution governor there in Texas at the same time. The other counties across the country that produce a high volume of capital cases, see if this is where you live, St. Louis County in Missouri, Tulsa and Oklahoma counties in OK, and Maricopa County, that's Phoenix, in Arizona. Leonard Peltier has been in prison since the 1970s, held responsible for the Wounded Knee Massacre. And whether or not you believe that he was responsible for the events that occurred, isn't it about time to release him from prison? Well, they have convened in Green Bay, Wisconsin, starting today, the Leonard Peltier Tribunal on the Abuse of Indigenous Peoples' Rights. And I think this is long overdue. I'm not sure how much impact it will have. This is essentially a parallel appeals process that doesn't have any weight with the government. But it may be useful in bringing attention and helping educate today's population about the long-term injustices weighed on the American Indian movement and, in particular, on Leonard Peltier. Well, the U.S. is in a little spat with Venezuela. They booted three of our diplomats out of Venezuela, and so in response, the United States has ordered three Venezuelan diplomats to leave the U.S. within 48 hours, including the highest-ranking member of their diplomatic contingent. And just yesterday, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro announced the expulsion of the U.S. charged affairs and two other diplomats, accusing them of conspiring with the extreme right to sabotage the South American country's economy and its power grid. And Venezuela has a right to be concerned and suspicious of U.S. intentions. It wasn't too many years ago we made a great effort to overthrow Hugo Chavez, and it was hardly a secret. So late on Tuesday, the State Department said it's expelling the charged affairs, Calixto Ortega Rios, and a second secretary and a consul at the Houston consulate. And the State Department says it's regrettable that the Venezuelan government has again decided to expel U.S. diplomatic officials based on groundless allegations, which require reciprocal action. Yes, they pissed on our leg, and so we're going to make sure their leg smells bad, too. So, we'll see where that one goes. And finally today, I want to acknowledge correspondence from Down Under. Hamish checked in, and he was provoked by my opening segment yesterday on News and Comment when I called Joe Nocio a hero. And Hamish correctly heard me struggling with the pronunciation of Mr. Nocio's name. At one point, I think I initially called him Nocio, and then I shifted to Nocio. And Hamish writes, basically saying, I know you don't appreciate all my remarks about language, but I thought I'd pass this on. Well, I do appreciate it. I care about language, and when I screw up, I don't mind if people point it out. So bring it on, and I will happily acknowledge when I'm wrong. What's interesting is, this morning, I managed to reach the attorney for Joseph Nocio, the former head of Quest Communications, who just got out of jail on September 20th, and who has a credible claim that he was railroaded into prison because he resisted NSA efforts to get collaboration from Quest Communications. So I got through to his lawyer to relay a request for an interview with Mr. Nacio, and based on this query from Hamish, I was curious enough to ask the attorney, so does he say Nacio or Nacio? And he says Nacio. But Hamish, you are technically correct. The way an Italian would say it would be Nacio. And I will let Hamish have the last word today. Regarding the mess in Washington, D.C., he writes, "It is both sickly comical and extremely troubling to witness the spectacle of your government allowing itself to be taken over by mentally defective criminals who probably couldn't manage to run a brothel at a profit without state-funded pimps. Sometimes I wonder whether the best thing would not be to hand the whole country over to the Koch brothers and the lunatic libertarians and see how long it takes before you have another civil war. But believe me, you have the sympathy of all of us who used to believe in the U.S. and now mourn for it." Well, thank you, Hamish. I accept your condolences. And it's Nacio. So there. Hey, thanks for listening, everybody. Drop me an email. Let me know what you think.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until